It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
The long-awaited matchup is here. It's Jim Mathias versus Mary Beth Carrozza. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Democratic State Senator Jim Mathias is being challenged by Republican delegate Mary Beth Carrozza in this year's November elections, where they made her announcement with the popular Republican Governor Larry Hogan at her side. This is a conservative district that Hogan won by 41 points in 2014. Mathias eked out his victory with just 3.4%. And that has been the norm for the former mayor of Ocean City. But Carrozza, a former staff member in the Ehrlich administration, is hoping to break that thin hold on the district. And we have her in our studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on.
So, first of all, in terms of your own background, I mean, you grew up around here. Tell me a little bit about your own background first in terms of where you grew up and your connection to the community.
Well, our family has been in this area since I was in fifth grade. Our family moved down from Baltimore to Ocean City, and my family operated the first fast food drive-through restaurant in Ocean City called Beefy's. And all of us were working in the family business at a very young age. I remember in the summer, my sixth grade summer, working full-time and ever since then. And that really gave us the opportunity to see how a family business operates because we were living it. And I think that experience has made me very sensitive to the challenges that our current family businesses face here on the shore.
So I've seen this race described as a moderate Democrat against a moderate Republican. Do you think that's an accurate description?
I'll be honest with you. I've always shied away from labels. And the reason I do is because I work very hard to represent the district. And when I went and did my door-to-door in 2013 and 14 and listened to the concerns and priorities of the constituents, I basically took those priorities, matched them with what Larry Hogan did, and of course he was successfully elected, used that partnership to advance the priorities. So I would, if you were going to come up with a label, I would like to think that I'm more of a grassroots Republican who is out there listening every day to her constituents.
Would you consider yourself a Hogan Republican?
You know, again, it's the labels. You know, I am a very strong partner with Governor Hogan, and we ran on very much the same platform. However, you know, I want folks to know that I also did vote for President Trump. And when I look, I always try to look at the positive where President Trump and Governor Hogan, what they have in common is their focus on job development and economic opportunity. And that's what I heard when I was going door to door. So that's where I've tried to keep my focus. That what really compelled me when I was doing the door to door back in 2013 and 14, and now doing it again for this campaign, is the consistency of folks that want to make sure that the opportunities, whether it's families, small business, and especially retirees, that those opportunities are here on the shore. I am a competitive person, and I was frustrated back in 2013 and 14 when I was hearing that our retirees were moving to Delaware or Virginia or to Florida. And that's something that we have begun to turn the tide on that under Governor Hogan's leadership. But I can tell you there's a lot more to do. I was just doing some visits in Cane Woods, which is the northern part of Ocean City. I was doing some rounds over by Mallard Lake, listening to the retirees there. And they are very concerned about their financial situation. And although we have begun to make some strides on tax relief for our military retirees, and we have under Governor Hogan's leadership increased those tax exemptions, I believe that that needs to be broadened, as does Governor Hogan, to provide more tax exemptions for retirees in general, so they have the incentive to stay here on the shore and not to look at developments and just going over the line in Delaware.
Do you see tax cut? I mean, beyond the retirement community, you see more tax cuts? Do you want to see more tax cuts? And if you do, then obviously the question is, where do you cut?
That's right. I think, you know, you look at targets, which is what I think Governor Hogan has done. he has been very realistic in his approach. And yes, in general, do I want tax cuts? Yes. I think we need to be strategic with our tax cuts, which is why I brought up retirees. That to me would be a priority. I also would look at the smaller businesses that are still struggling. Right now, the economy is on an upward tick. And as I'm talking to, whether it's businesses in Salisbury or Somerset County or Ocean City, for the most part, it's been pretty positive where we are with our economic landscape. But they're looking ahead. And I do think we have to look at both, not just our tax policies, but also our regulations. Really understand, of course, we need regulations, but how do we structure them so they don't actually put our small businesses out of business?
Before I leave the taxes, so if you cut taxes, you're going to cut revenue. So then the question becomes, so where do you then cut the budget? I mean, do you think that there's something in the budget, in the state budget now, that deserves a major cut?
So I think Governor Hogan, when he has proposed his budgets, he has really put the pressure on every individual state agency and department to glean all the efficiencies that you can. And because I worked for Governor Ehrlich and right. I had that experience when I was a deputy chief of staff, you know, there's this whole process, and it's why Maryland's very unique, because the budget authorities in Maryland are more powerful than almost any other state, meaning that when the governor, regardless of whether it's a Democrat or Republican, proposes the budget, when it comes to us in the Maryland General Assembly, we can only cut. And so what that means is we know there's going to be trade-offs. So it is up to us. And I lived this the past 4 years in the appropriations process, where you have to go through and see where you can make some cuts. So the trade-off being the Maryland General Assembly likes to come back right. And say, okay, well, we would like to see some increases in these areas. I believe then the pressure for us on the shore, again, going back to the folks that I represent, is understanding the shore priorities. And the only way we do that is to make sure there's a local consensus. So if we come out, it became very clear that there was a consensus in Salisbury that they wanted to, that the downtown revitalization would be a priority. And under Jake Day's leadership, looking at funding at every level, federal, state, you know, the city, the matches that you can get from the private sector to the extent that we can do that. So when you have a project like that, that was very easy to get behind. And all of us say, all of the Wicomico County delegation, because there's five of us in Wicomico County, people forget that the Salisbury downtown revitalization, Governor Hogan has put $1 million in his budget for that. We need to then protect that. And then, of course, if there's any opportunity for some small increases, you work for those too. The point of talking this much about the budget process is that the front end work is absolutely critical. So what I've been trying to do during this interim is when people are, you know, seeing me out and about, some of them are coming up on the fly. Some of them are making appointments to say, you know, we would like some additional funding for this or for that. So an example would be right now, it looks like that the community, there's a consensus of moving forward with Poplar Hill being a drug treatment, recovery, and job training all on one campus. Now, as what I'm starting to see is the community coalesce behind that. And if that's the case, then we should be successful in securing money at the county level and securing money at the state level and then whatever federal money might be involved. So I've already talked to Clay Stamp, who heads up Governor Hogan's heroin opioid intervention team. And he is well aware of this, has already been down here and in contact with the locals on that. So that's an example of if we know that that is a local priority, which I believe that is a strong local priority for the shore that will benefit not just Wicomico County, but serve the three lower shore counties and possibly Dorchester County as well, and maybe beyond the shore, that on the shore, that we can then make a case for looking for some funding at the state level. Also, as you may or may not be aware, each county has their own local heroin opioid intervention team. And those teams are essential because, for instance, in Worcester County, they coalesced and came up with their recommendation that they wanted to use whatever state money came down to put some peer resource specialist in the emergency rooms at Atlantic General Hospital so that when folks came in, possibly ODing or with their drug problems right there in the emergency room, that's the most critical time that they would probably turn for help and be open to it. So having those peer recovery specialists right there on site became a priority. So that's an example where, again, I try to use my experience on the Appropriations Committee. I am on the Health and Human Services Subcommittee, so the funding is coming through there, and link it to what we are hearing are the priorities at the local level. That's the way the budget can work for the Shore.
But you bring up the issue about the opioid issue, and of course we had this mailer that was put out by the Maryland Republican Party basically saying that Mathias favored mobile drug dens. What's your reaction to that in terms of a mailer and how it characterizes your opponent?
Well, number one, I separate the two. I separate the mailer from the issue. The mailer, I would not have done it that way, and I'll just leave it at that. However, the issue itself is a clear contrast between Senator Mathias and myself. He co-sponsored a piece of legislation that took taxpayer funds and provided for heroin injections on local sites. And my experience, number one, I strongly oppose that legislation, and I oppose it based on my participation in the local meetings that I participate in both Worcester and Wicomico at this point and eventually Somerset. And it's very clear, the example I use in the consensus, they are saying, no, we want to use our funds for this. We want to put these specialists in the emergency rooms, catch people as they're coming in there. This idea of heroin injections paid for by the taxpayers, you know, maybe an idea like that works in Amsterdam, maybe even New York City. But from all of my experience working with, you know, in Maryland and with the locals, Sheriff Mike Lewis, other local law enforcement, those who are involved in treatment and recovery, they will tell you there's a better use of our taxpayer funds.
We should, of course, mention that the state senator did withdraw his support. He withdrew the bill. But it leads to me to another question, which I've always had, which is, you know, back in the 1980s, when we had a drug problem in the African-American community, crack cocaine, the response, particularly by conservatives, the Republican Party, was three strikes and you're out, lock them up. Just say no. Now, suddenly, we're talking about treatment when it has now gone beyond the minority community. What about that contradiction?
Well, I don't see it so much as a contradiction. If you look at what Governor Hogan proposed with the Justice Reinvestment Act, that legislation, which has and continues to have strong bipartisan support, and by the way, is being overseen by our own Judge Danny Long, which is, again, good for the Shore. What that bill does, and now that we're carrying it out, is we want to take, there seems to be a recognition, a consensus that those who are in prison because they're addicted to drugs, that jailing them, imprisoning them is not the way for their future recovery. And so there's been a recognition by both parties with this bill that, you know, you would like that population, you want them to focus more on the treatment and put them on the road to recovery. At the same time, there's got to be a balance. And the legislation that Governor Hogan introduced that was passed this past session did increase the penalties for those that are running the drug operations. So I think that there is bipartisan consensus on that. You want to those that are having the drug problems as far as they're addicted, you want to put them on a road to treatment and recovery, whereas you want to go after, meaning stiffer penalties for those who are actually running the businesses and profiting from it.
I want to turn to offshore wind. Great debate, certainly in Ocean City proposal, initial proposal. I think it was a little over 12 miles from Ocean City. Ocean City officials have said, no, they don't want it. Where are you on that? And is a project that goes further out and off the shore viable? I've seen quotes where some of the folks who are involved with these kinds of projects say, if you push it too far out, it doesn't work. It's a deal killer, I think, is one point. Where are you on that?
Where I am with the offshore wind project is, number one, I started by attending the forums that were held in public. I attended the one at Stephen Decatur Junior High in Berlin. I've attended the one in Ocean City. I've attended the ones in Annapolis. So first of all, I thought, because I wasn't in the legislature when this legislation passed, I believe it was back in 2012, 2013, that I had to put the pressure on myself to, first of all, become smarter about the issue, playing catch up on it. And so what I did is I wanted to listen. In one of the forums that I attended with Mayor Rick Meehan from Ocean City, it became clear that when they had the posters of showing the visibility of the towers, that of the windmills, that became very clear that, and it, watching Mayor Rick Meehan's reaction, that was the first time that the visibility issue was so transparent. And at that point, Mayor Rick Meehan, what came out of that, which I thought was very worthwhile, is he said, I believe that this visibility issue has to be shared with the public. I am going to invite each one of the applicants in, U.S. Wind and Skipjack, into City Hall and in front of the mayor and city council, have a public meeting, allow each one of them separately to present present the project to the public. I thought that was a really good outcome, because then the conversation, the public, we could have that honest, open debate about it. I am concerned about the visibility is one of the issues I'm concerned about, mainly because you don't want to hurt one economic driver to support another economic driver that also would help the economy and the environment. So I was very sensitive that when you had the Ocean City Hotel Motel Restaurant Association, you had the Ocean City Chamber of Commerce, they're raising concerns about what the economic impact could be. And we know that it's competitive, and you could envision that Virginia Beach would run ads that said, come to Virginia Beach where your beach view is pristine, and, you know, showing what the windmills might look like. You know, that could be used as a competitive advantage against us. The visibility is one issue that I am hopeful that they can work through that issue. The other issues that I think should be raised that haven't been talked about enough. We just had a forum where the coastal fishing industry came in, and they presented to the Ocean City Mayor and City Council. They presented the impact that the windmills could have on the fishing industry, as far as the disruption to their fishing lanes, disruption where it could have possibly push fish in different areas, and they also raised safety issues. It was my understanding that this was the first time that the fishing industry had their own forum to present their concerns. Yes, they had come and attended some of the public meetings, but they had their own presentation presented to the Ocean City Mayor and City Council, and also representatives at the state and federal level were there. So they are now raising issues on the impact of the fishing industry, which already has great challenges, even just getting in and out of our channel in West Ocean City. The two other issues I think that should be brought up so people just have all the information is, what will be the impact on ratepayers, a true cost on the ratepayers, and what is the true cost to taxpayers?
Let me ask you this. It seems as if what we're really looking at is perhaps foreclosing having offshore wind, at least off the coast of Ocean City. I mean, the that what you're describing to me is so complicated, that the situation is so complicated that, that in the end, that's where you're going to be.
Well, number one, I believe, again, I base my...
I base
my decisions on information. So initially, the whole debate seemed to focus on the visibility issue. Yeah. I am very concerned about the impact on the fishing industry. I also am an optimistic person by heart. You know, the fact that windmills are operating off the coast of Europe, that are operating in other parts in Rhode Island, I want to see what is working there and if what's working there could possibly work off of Ocean City. But I'm also sensitive that we may have different issues than some of these other communities that are outside of Maryland and outside of the country. So I believe that some really tough issues still need to be worked through before we could go forward with windmills off of Ocean City.
I want to turn to education. I mean, I know that you've emphasized the idea about cool school choice, for example, homeschooling and so on. Which is all well and good, but most students are probably going to go through the public education system. I mean, that's just all there is to it. So what do you see in terms of funding public education? What do you mean by accountability? Because I know you talk about that. And how would that impact particularly teachers who may feel as if the evaluation system is not fair?
First of all, starting with education, I really am proud of my record in supporting Governor Hogan's record level funding for education every year, all 4 years. So I want to highlight that. I have focused in a couple areas of education. And one of the areas that I have focused on, which I am really glad to see that there's now a focus at both the federal and more of a focus with Governor Hogan's leadership at the state level, is career trade technology education. And the reason I'm excited about this, when I was first elected in 2014, and within like the first month and a half when I was up in Annapolis, I was approached by the construction industry employers. And they came to me, and this is just one example of the career trade technology education. And they came to me and they said, Mary Beth, we have a challenge of a lack of a skilled workforce. If you look at the average age on a construction site, it's like, I believe, in the low to mid 50s, which means they're starting to age out and they don't see the pipeline of a new skilled workforce coming through. And they had some frustrations with working with the school systems. And I saw this as a perfect opportunity to use my role as delegate to do and strengthen partnerships between the school systems and the employers. So what I did is I invited some of the industry, the local construction industry employers. Some of them include Delaware Elevator, based in Salisbury, DeCarlo participated, and they came in and we had students. We brought them in. We brought the eighth graders in because I believe you actually should start impacting more sixth, seventh, eighth grade to plant those seeds. And we had also some of the current Worcester Technical High School students. So that would be 9 through 12. And then we also brought in the counselors and the teachers and allowed the employers to make their case and tell their story that these are both high tech and lucrative positions. High tech in that we had folks that were showing how drones are involved, you know, on construction sites. High tech that you are actually doing your drawings and your measurements and everything on your iPads. Lucrative in that we passed out a chart that showed entry-level construction industry employees start between $30,000 to $60,000 a year. And then with additional training and layer on some business skills where they're more attractive to employers and maybe setting them up for eventually having their own business down the road, those salaries increase as you go up the line. So it was exciting to see, number one, the counselors' eyes lighting up because, quite frankly, I think there's been a little bit of a stigma with the trades. It was exciting to watch the students' reaction with they had a kind of a video that showed these construction sites where they're using some of this and showing the salaries, showing people eventually starting their own businesses. And I realized then after that forum, I actually had then Assistant Superintendent Lou Taylor of the Worcester County Schools, who is now the superintendent, somebody I went to school with, grade school with, say to me, Mary Beth, we need to pull in more of our parents, more of our counselors, more of our students in middle school to paint this picture and to tell this story. My point in going into that much detail is that when we talk about education, we're not just talking about what the Kerwin Commission is doing to look at revamping the funding formula, which, by the way, we need to fight and make sure the shore receives its fair share of those funding formulas. But we're looking at how we change some of our emphasis, or at least increase the emphasis in certain areas that may have been overlooked. I really do believe that in education, there has been too much focus on a traditional four-year academic college track. And as the result, some of those students are coming out with debt and they're not able to find jobs. At the same time, we have employers coming to us. It's why I really support what we're doing at Warwick and what we're doing at SU with the business school. Warwick and SU involve the employers when they develop their education programs. They're listening. And if you look at this area, what the potential is, healthcare, what we're doing at PRMC, what we're doing at AGH, the movement to community health, the fact that in this area that we have a proportionately higher retiree population. So we know that the healthcare services are going to be needed even more so, which means we need a skilled workforce.
So where the teachers come in, particularly when you're talking about accountability? Because again, if I'm a teacher and I'm saying, well, gee, you know, you're going to evaluate me, but if I, for instance, if I teach in a low-income area, those things are going to be much different than if I'm out in some wealthy suburb. I mean,
okay, how so do you let's address talk that? About teachers. Number one, yeah. I am delighted that the Kerwin Commission has focused on teaching as a profession. If you look at the promotional and career and leadership track for teachers, usually in order for them to increase their salaries, they have to go into the administration. What we need to do is recognize and have a teacher leadership track. We want our good teachers to stay, you know, in the classrooms. And I believe one way to do that is you have to, first of all, recognize that we have a teaching shortage. Number two, that you have to approach teaching as a profession, which means it should be valued the same way that we value accountants, the same way we value attorneys, the same way we value doctors and nurses. So that does, it's not just a salary issue. It's how you approach the whole, their training. It's how you pursue their promotional track. It's how you recognize them. It's how you give more control to the teachers. Case in point, I was doing some door-to-door on Sunday in Salisbury, and I had a grandmother who has custody of her student, of her grandchild, tell me that she wants the local teachers empowered. She said to me, I don't think I should have to be the one that comes in to take my granddaughter's mobile phone away from her. I believe that the teachers should have the authority in the classrooms. It's one example. I heard another example when I was going door to door where it was very clear that the teacher in that classroom was on overload and needed some support. The fact that a parent or a grandparent can recognize that, call it to my attention. I took that example to Dr. Hanlon and said, we need to give our teachers the support in the classrooms. So what does it mean as far as the budget and as far as our policies? We need to pay attention to the Kerwin Commission recommendations. I believe that you will see come out of those recommendations, teaching elevated as a profession. I believe that we have to fairly compensate our teachers. But I also believe you need to give them more tools, and I believe you need to give them more local authority.
Just briefly, because we are sitting on this campus of Salisbury University, do you expect that tuition, the costs are going to continue to go up for students higher education in Maryland?
Well, briefly? I do think Governor Hogan's, the initiative he's taken to try to keep the control on tuition is the right way to go. When I think about, we now have new leadership here at Salisbury University. I am actually looking forward to my sit down with the new president. I know that he initially had the transition with, which is always an interesting and busy time, but the new president has agreed to see me before the start of the school session, which I'm pleased about that because I think this is a critical time. So I believe that, number one, that we have, we in public positions have to do everything we can to keep tuition affordable. And so I'm going to continue to support those efforts. I also am going to continue to encourage our own local students to look at our state schools. We have a teaching shortage here on the shore. Salisbury University is an excellent school in pursuing, the education field. So that's something that I also point out that our state delegate and state Senate scholarships can only support students going to Maryland community colleges and schools. So I see that all of this comes together. But I did want to focus on the two areas that I did want to focus on when you brought education was the career trade technology area and also the teaching as a profession.
I want to turn to the environment. One is obviously how you balance the concerns about the environment versus obviously whether it's the farmers or the watermen. And in particular, I was curious about what your position was in terms of the large chicken houses, what they call CAFOs, which are really relatively new development within the poultry industry. I've talked to a number of folks who are not opposed to having them built. They just don't want them built next to their development. Where are you on that? Do you think we need more regulation of some kind, or should that be, say, left to the local level? What kind of concerns?
I think we have to strike the balance because we know how important the poultry industry and farming is to Delmarva. And, you know, we talk about tourism and we talk about farming and agriculture as our economic drivers. And I also think we touched a little bit on how healthcare can continue to be an economic driver for this area. But going back to the large poultry houses, I believe in the local process as far as working through it. So, you know, I do not support those who take a position that there should not be any of the large poultry houses. They should outright be eliminated. At the same time, I don't think that everything goes that, if somebody wants to come in and invest that, you know, we should not look at all of the other concerns. So how do we find that balance? It seems to me that in Wicomico County, they have worked through that. They're working through it by how do you, you know, if you want to go forward with these poultry houses, how do you strike that balance where maybe it's the number, maybe it's the size, maybe it's the location. So I absolutely agree that to me, local involvement, local input is the key to it.
But what do you say to residents who say they saw, for instance, whether it's Wicomico County or Worcester County and so on, they see the local restrictions that were newly put on, and they say they're not tough enough. They still won't keep those things away necessarily from our developments.
Well, I mean, in some cases, looks like the system has worked because, as I understand, on one of the large poultry houses that was proposed that eventually became the site of a sod farm. And to me, if that was the end result and that we work through that maybe that wasn't the ideal location for that poultry house there, but there was, again, another option, I don't think that other option would have come about had there not been the local input. So I believe that you have to take these regulations and apply them to real life. So it's why you have to have the Farm Bureau along with, you know, Coastal Bays, along with our elected officials, they have to be around the same table. And I really do believe for too long that when it came to these regulations, that we were missing our farmers, you know, those who are actually being most impacted, sitting around the table on the early end. I do think we're doing a better job of addressing these issues on the early end. So I am going to continue to urge local input and to do so in a constructive way. You know, what I have found, whether it's this issue or, you know, working right now, we have the challenge of the our challenge right now of increasing correctional officers down at ECI. Whatever those challenges might be, recognizing that if we can, at least on the early end, what I have found in my public service is that sometimes it's too late in the process and emotions are so, they're already set and people have taken hardline positions because it happens at the end of the process and we didn't involve everybody on the the locals on the early end. So that's, you know, I am going to look for every opportunity to support the poultry industry and our local farmers with the input of our local communities.
By the way, to the Bay, and obviously the question is, how do you balance the concerns of the watermen as opposed to the folks who are concerned about the environment? One can say they're both concerned about it in some fashion or another. And there have been efforts in Washington to either cut restoration funds, as you know, or there's an amendment, I think, in Washington now that would pull the EPA back from requiring, from punishing or pushing states to achieve what's called a pollution diet. Where are you in terms of dealing with the Bay and how do you balance those?
Well,
two?
I think you're right to set up the question on what happens at the federal level does impact us at the state level. And I will continue to support Governor Hogan's efforts. He has put a priority on not only the Chesapeake Bay cleanup, but also for us, and it impacts us most, is the coastal waterways. And, you know, what I think what he's done is, number one, he's put himself in a leadership position. I believe that that position rotates with the governors, and Governor Hogan has had the opportunity to lead on the Chesapeake Bay group with the governors. And also now with his leadership position with the National Governors Association, that puts him in a position to better understand how, when policies are made at the federal level, how they're going to impact the states. So number one, we should appreciate the fact that Governor Hogan's in a position that, a leadership position, that he understands that and can impact it. Number two, I think if you look at the Governor Hogan's environmental record, and I have supported his environmental initiatives, that we are making progress. If you look at the report cards for the Chesapeake Bay and the coastal bays, we are making progress. I think we have to continue to put some pressure up on the northern part of the state.
Because, Conowingo Bay, Eckerton
exactly,
Dam.
Exactly, because that runoff does affect us
right.
On the shore. And we put, instead of putting all the pressure on our own local farmers, we should be looking at what are they doing to make improvements to that dam and keeping the pressure on, which Governor Hogan has done. So, again, I believe that we are making progress. I believe we have to keep the pressure on, because if you don't keep the pressure on the cleanup, then if it's not visible, it tends to not stay as a priority. I believe in that process, we have to continue, as I think we are doing now successfully, pulling in our local farm bureaus and, you know, those members in Wicomico and in Worcester and in Somerset, and talk through, what are you doing on your farms? What is working as some of the procedures that they put in place? Where do you need more help in order to actually meet, you know, the regulatory requirements? So I believe we're on the right track, but I think you're absolutely right that we have to stay focused on it.
By the way, I want to turn to healthcare real quickly. There's a possibility that funding for the ACA could disappear. We've had efforts to repeal it. I know there's concern about what Maryland can do. What do you see Maryland doing in terms of ensuring that whoever gets left behind does not get left behind? I mean, I know you are not a favor of Ben Jealous's proposal for sort of a health care for all. What's your solution?
Well, first of all, you're right to set up the question. What happens at the federal level certainly is impacting us at the state level. And Maryland, of course, is very unique because we have our waiver. And Governor Hogan and the administration, with bipartisan support, have been successful in protecting that waiver. So number one, we have to protect and support what works for the state of Maryland, regardless of what happens at the federal level. I am looking forward at coming up at MACO, the Maryland Association of Counties Conference in Ocean City. I have been asked to be a moderator on a rural health panel. And I'm excited about that because we are bringing in the Maryland Rural Coalition, the Maryland Rural Health Association, the Health Resources Commission, which has grants, which funds some of our local health care initiatives and putting emphasis on rural initiatives. We are going to use this forum to go through the recommendations that the Maryland Rural Health Coalition has made to see what recommendations have already gone forward with legislation in the past, what we need to do for next session, what we need to do for the budget. And the reason I'm trying to connect all these dots is, again, the timing is such that we're in the process of the budget being developed. So we're specifically going to have a forum on rural health in Maryland, and we can use the recommendations from that coalition and from this forum, I believe, to move ahead. And going to your point, which is, regardless of what happens at the federal level, we have to make sure if they change funding formulas, if they change policies, how do we continue to make sure that what works in Maryland continues? And I'm looking forward to this panel of experts. I am not an expert on healthcare,
right,
but I am a good strategist and I'm a good generalist. And I believe that we can take these ideas and make sure that the Hogan administration has those ideas on the front end of the budget, and also that our leadership of the Maryland General Assembly. I want to give credit to Senator Addie Eckert. She's a nurse by background. She has been working on healthcare issues, not only in her profession, but as both a longtime member of the House of Delegates and now as a state senator. She knows these issues inside and out. And she is in a position that she understands when they make changes at the federal level, how it's going to impact the state, and give that input on the early end to the Hogan administration.
Let me ask you briefly, because I know I've talked to Congressman Andy Harris, and he favors repeal of the Affordable Care Act. One, I would be curious about what your feeling is about that. And two, he seemed to be emphasizing high-risk pools as opposed to the kind of system we have now. Would you favor repeal of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I guess I'm realistic. I believe that there's parts of the ACA that just simply are not going to be repealed. And the parts that, if there are parts that are working that benefit Maryland, I would not want that repealed. Yeah. At the same time, I think where, you know, what Congressman Harris is highlighting with these pools, I do believe that, you know, we should look at those options. I'll tell you, between we have some outstanding leadership when it comes to our state agencies, when it comes to healthcare and healthcare insurance. Al Redmer, you know, he has taken his background and, you know, is really applying it to make sure that we can keep healthcare affordable and accessible by working with the health department. The deputy of the health department, Dennis Schrader, somebody I've worked with very closely in both the Ehrlich administration and this administration, is in a leadership role that he has worked very hard to understand and to ensure that what happens at the federal level, we can protect at the state level. And I want to give him a lot of credit because he was like the lead on protecting Maryland's waiver. So I guess my point on this is that we have to take the best of the best in our administration and our leadership in the Maryland General Assembly and make sure that we're protecting Maryland. Healthcare is changing. I've spent time with PRMC, with AGH, with our primary doctors, nurses, those who are providing therapy and rehabilitation. Healthcare is moving to community and population health, which means if we can set up having good systems in place on the early end again, then we can keep people from making as many hospital visits or using the emergency room as their healthcare system or cut down on the readmissions to hospitals. And in order for that to work, and what you're seeing PRMC do, I think, very successfully in AGH, is they are strengthening the partners with the doctors, with the other primary care givers in order to make sure that there are partnerships. So when somebody does come to the hospital, it can be an efficient care. They're released in a timely way and we prevent their readmission. And this is taking a whole community and state refocus as we move in this area. And the Shore is prime to not only have the best quality healthcare services, I keep going back to our retiree population. We're going to need good, we're going to need a skilled workforce to support that industry as well.
I want to ask you about this. As I've particularly watched politics, particularly over the last maybe 10 years here on the Shore, there seems to be a conflict between urban areas and the rural areas. And one of the things I'm curious about is whether or not sending, say, someone who's a Republican to the state Senate, which has a majority, Democratic majority, whether or not we're going to lose something in the process. I know we had, there was some discussion when Norm Conway, who was a Democrat, sat on the Appropriations Committee. When he lost to a Republican, the question became, didn't we lose something in the process in terms of our voice in the state legislature? So how do you convince somebody to say, well, you know, I really like Mary Beth and really sounds great, but I want to make sure that we get our share of the bacon, as it were, and maybe I should be sending a Democrat to that Senate who's obviously going to have a majority of Democrats.
Well, first of all,
how do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, I look at the district that I represent. Mm-hmm. And the district that I represent, it would be all of Somerset, all of Worcester, and all of Wicomico. And I look at the priorities of that area. And number one, I have used my role on the Appropriations Committee to make sure the Shore gets its fair share of funding. One way to do that, again, is on the front end by working with Governor Hogan on the budget on the front end. And I have been a strong partner with Governor Hogan on that. At the same time, when I'm elected to the state Senate, I'll be one of 47. That means you are in a role where you have more authority and you do have more power, and those relationships are important. I valued my relationships on the Appropriations Committee with our chairman, Maggie McIntosh. I felt very comfortable going to her. I base it on fairness. And one thing that I know I can effectively do when it comes to funding, it's an issue of fairness for the Shore. I know I have been effective doing that as a Republican on the House Appropriations Committee, and I will be effective as a Republican in the state Senate, even more so because of the limited number of senators and working with those other senators, even more so because of the smaller number. I go back to, you have to understand the priorities of your district. I understand the priorities of this district because I'm out there and I'm doing the door-to-door, and I'm doing the listening, and I've already put these partnerships in place as a delegate that I can then, those will be the same partnerships that I take with me to the state Senate to move forward. I also am making this election very much about supporting Governor Hogan's reelection. And the reason I am is because Maryland is on the right track. And I can tell you, voter after voter that I talk to, they consistently talk about they want to stay on that track. They do not want to go back to what happened in the 8 years of the O'Malley administration. They don't want to turn back. And Governor Hogan, if you look at his success, he zeroed in on some key areas and has been very successful. And I've been his partner in those key areas: jobs, economic development, focusing on the heroin opioid crisis, picking some key areas in education, listening to our employers, moving forward in that way. So you look at the success of the past 4 years, and I believe I represent this district. They are telling me we want to continue on that track. And I know I'm in the best position by these partnerships that I've built, by the priorities I focused on that reflect the priorities of the district to move forward. So, you know, as far as my role in the state Senate, I will continue to be effective in the state Senate as I have been as a delegate and working with Governor Hogan in the next administration.
A couple of other questions before I let you go. One is, do you think we need a third span across the bay?
You know,
I mean, I was in there. Actually, I was coming back the other day and I'm thinking, certainly would have been nice. But
I think it's heading in that direction. And I think the issue really will be about, number one, location, and also about funding. So right. It certainly appears that we are on that track. And as I'm talking to people, again, when it comes back to local input, every person I ask has a different opinion of where the span should go.
Right.
And so, you know, I guess to me, I'm like, okay, we'll have to work through that issue. We first have to have the consensus that the third span is needed, and then you work through, you know, where it should be cited.
One other thing that just popped out at me, it said that your favorite book is by Donald Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld's Rules. Now, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I've often been a critic of Mr. Rumsfeld, particularly as the defense time. But what did you find so beneficial about his book? And was there a particular rule that you thought really stood out to you?
Yes. First of all, I had the opportunity to work for Secretary
Rumsfeld.
That's
right. You were the Defense Department.
And to prepare for my job interview, I actually went and read the book and read the rules. And what it did is it gave me more a sense of how he operated as a leader. And it was very clear when I read that book and when I have thought about the Rumsfeld rules that he kept the focus on public service, that is why in the end we have these positions, that it's not your own personal agenda or if you even had a particular issue that you wanted to highlight or a constituency that you wanted to highlight, that in the end, this was about public service. And I remember that a couple of these rules, number one, he said, and this is somebody who is very confident in his own abilities, and this is what struck me. He said in one of his rules, you know, don't be afraid to say, I don't know, and then go out and find the answers. I think there's a tendency in our positions that you know, somebody asks you a question and you have to come up with the answer. And so I thought about that because he was sending a message to us that, you know, you may not know the answer, but I also expect you to get the answer and come back to me and give me options and recommendations. The other rule that he shared, and I just, he was kind enough to come and do an event for me when I ran for state delegate. And I had the opportunity to share this rule with him in front of others. He said, enjoy your public service as hard as it may be, because when you look back, it will be the best times of your life. And I realized that was just so insightful because we tend to get caught up in the issue or problem that's right in front of us. And of course, politics can be hard. You can be getting attacked from all sides, but he was saying, take a step back, enjoy your public service. And I believe I have taken that to heart because it's why I go out and do so much one-on-one voter contact, nothing in between us. hearing directly from the voters and really savoring and enjoying those moments and taking those moments and seeing, you know, then how can then maybe I improve the quality of life on the shore in my small way. And so I really did take that advice to heart.
Do you think that given the tumultuous times that we seem to be living through, that we've lost sight of that? That some of our leaders have lost sight of that?
You know, I look at what happens at the federal level, and sometimes it can be a little disappointing, but I am reminded of what Governor Hogan reminds us of, which is we're not Washington, we're Maryland, and I really tend to focus on the good because when I'm out and about, I get ideas from, you know, from students, from business people, from farmers, from watermen, from veterans, from teachers, just from retirees across the board. And what takes me a little while, I listen to them and I try to sift through and find that one nugget. And I can tell you in almost every encounter, someone will offer you an insight or a recommendation or an idea that we might not have thought of. And I said, you know, I'd like to share that. If you'll allow me, see how we can put that to work. And then when I do take positions, whether it's on legislation or whether it's on policies or regulations, I'm in a stronger position because I can say, here's the input that I have received directly from the voters. So I'm going to remain optimistic. My mother has always been optimistic, and I think I picked up that trait from my mom and my work ethic from my dad, and I'm going to combine those two and keep doing the best job I can.
Final question. So as you know, most people I've talked to say this should have been a Republican district, that Jim Mathias has eked it out every time, despite the voting registration and so on. And we're now facing what potentially is a blue wave. We'll see how that works out. What is it? I mean, why do you think you're going to make it across the line where other people didn't?
I will make it across the line and I'll be the next state senator because I am more representative of this district at this point in time. I go back to one of the predecessors, Senator Lowell Stolfus, did a fine job representing this area. He has endorsed me and offered his support. And when you look at the makeup of the district, and not just the numbers, I mean, the numbers themselves, it's a Republican district.
Right.
But I base it more on not Republican or Democrat or independents. I base it on these one-on-one encounters that I have. And hearing the feedback from the voters and knowing the policies and initiatives that Governor Hogan is pushing, that I am pushing and supporting, I know that I'm more representative of this district at this point in time. And I will continue to listen to the constituents, not get caught up in the establishment in Annapolis, the establishment in D.C. Stay focused on my constituents, listen to them. My job is then to glean from them, to help make those priorities, and then to push those priorities. Sometimes it's pushing a priority, and sometimes it's killing a bad initiative or a bad bill. But I know from my interaction for the past 4 years, and particularly being all the one-on-one interaction that I have, that I am most representative of District 38, and I will continue to listen to the voters.
We've been speaking with Delegate Mary Beth Carrozza. She is running, of course, for the state Senate against Democratic Senator Jim Mathias, and we'll see how it all turns out, I guess.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for stopping by. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.